I'm Gab. He's Jules. There's blue skies over West London. For now, Jules, yeah. We've learned the weather can be changeable here. We have a full show for you because the Euros are coming up just on Friday. It's like 4 days away,
crazy,
Jules.
Man.
But we're going to have George Atala on. He's the executive director of the NFL Players Association. Sorry, assistant executive director.
Yes.
Dee Smith, of course, is the executive director. And you might ask, why are we having him on? Well, because he knows a lot about how sports are structured on the other side of the pond and on this side of the pond, because he's a big gooner as well. I think he can cut through some of the BS that people have thrown out about American owners, the Super League, and what unions do, and
there's
so
a lot
on.
Of things to learn from how they also run their sports in the U.S.
Absolutely. And, of course, we've got quick hits. We've got Conte's situation. We've got the Ronald Koeman situation.
All we have friendlies.
The friendlies. How about Jordan Henderson?
Yes.
Big footing, Marcus Rashford. But let's start with our preview of the first two groups, Group A and Group B at Euro 2020. Group A, Italy, Switzerland, Turkey, Wales. Okay, I'll leave it to you to say. You know, we always want to step back if we're Italy fans, but the reality is Italy have I think it's completely irrelevant, but Italy have historically done better when they go into tournaments not on a high.
Yep.
They're absolutely flying right now. They're really, really fun to watch. They're talented. They're progressive. They're proactive. The strongest area of the pitch, by far, is the midfield, which I think is something
crazy.
We've almost never seen in Italy side, Jules.
Yeah, that's right, Gab. And I think you're excited, and rightly so. And I think everybody in Italy should be excited. I think Mancini is doing a great job. They obviously had this really long unbeaten run where they had time to build and build on confidence as well, on exactly how he wanted them to play. And when you look at that midfield, whether you go with Verratti, Jorginho, Locatelli or Barella.
Pellegrini
as well. All those different profiles that you can bring and pick from depending on who you play against or what the game is offering you or, you know, whatever. I think it's great. You've got the old guard at the back. I'm not sure how long Chiellini and Bonucci will play together. But even that, you've got Bastoni behind. My only issue, and you know, is how far can you go without a prolific striker if Immobile, Belotti,
but tell me this. What is the logic, right? Okay, so Ciro Immobile, we look at him and we say he's not a prolific striker. But then you look at the last 4 years in Serie A, he scored a ton of goals. And you might come back, it's Serie A, it's not the Premier League. It's fine, I don't care, it's not the Premier League. But he's still playing against better competition in Serie A than most of these international defenses he's going to face.
Wales?
I would argue.
Because otherwise, he faced Demiral and Soyuncu against Turkey.
Okay, I'll give
and
you.
And Akanji and don't know who's going to play next to him for Switzerland. But
right, but there is the occasional good defense in Serie A as well. But what I'm saying is, you know, he has scored a lot. He scored a ton of goals. This idea that he doesn't do it at international level is because he's missed a lot of goals in a lot of high-profile games for Italy. But I wonder, again, sample size and so on, if they create enough chances for him, you have to believe he's going to score. But I agree with you, the alternatives, Andrea Belotti, who was on a horrible team last year, didn't score a lot of goals, but works hard, and my man Jack Raspadori, who, of course, only made his debut the other day.
Yeah, he's young.
So,
but you could go. I'm just wondering where the goal is going to come from, because you're going to create, and as we've seen, and I think there's a limit to how much Barella and Verratti can score, certainly Verratti, and Jorginho's penalties, and then what, set pieces? Okay, but then who from your front three, again, whether that's Insigne, let's say Insigne, Immobile, and
Chiesa
probably, we'll start up front. You will need a lot of goal as well, potentially from Chiesa and Insigne, if Immobile is not in that sort of like striking form.
What I like about this is you have a lot of players who are not afraid to shoot and not take responsibility.
Yeah,
and that's something different that we have. In Italy in the past, it's always been, oh, you're the star player. Okay, Mr. Totti, you shoot from wherever you want, as much as you want, and then everybody else will just go and win the ball back. It's not like that anymore.
Yeah.
Those midfielders, they're young. They're not afraid to take responsibility. Chiesa's not afraid. Berardi's certainly not afraid. So we'll see how it goes. Turkey, on paper, looks to be perhaps the second best team in this in this group. Are you on board with that? Or is there a sense that perhaps Burak Yilmaz has had a fantastic season up front?
Yeah.
But he's older, and I think maybe that season took a lot out of him.
Yeah, maybe there's a bit of that, although he missed 2 months at the end of 2020, so he was not like a full he had time to just kind of rest a little bit, if you want. I just they're amongst my dark horses. I can really see them being a pain to play against because they're so solid defensively. And I remember when they beat France after the 2018 World Cup, and I know that was a long time ago already, but still, the idea is the same, and the core of the team is the same. Havertz, Soyuncu, Demiral, centre-halves is pretty good.
That's one of the best defensive partnerships.
Definitely, and come back on
better
the
than Italy's.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, potentially as well. You know, having
better than France's too, maybe.
Behave here. But you know, you've got players like Yazici who can create. You've got good fullbacks. You've got Burak Yılmaz. You've got Cengiz Under probably on the bench, and Enes Unal as well. So I think you've got talent everywhere, and there will be a team that are solid, and that's what they do. They're solid. They're so aggressive. They're in your face all the time, and I think everybody will hate to play against them.
That solidity is something that in the past with Turkey has been missing, because they have been a little bit, especially emotionally, up and down. Switzerland, on the other hand, have been super solid historically. I look at this. There are a number of quality players. There's a very smart manager in Petkovic.
Yeah.
And if they start out with a win against Wales, I don't think, and you assume that with 4 points, you have a good chance of going through.
Definitely.
I think they can feel pretty good about their chances.
I think you're right. And we will talk in a bit about the Belgium Golden Generation. This is very similar with this Switzerland squad, because you've got some good youngsters coming through, but it's still the Chakas and Shaqiris and, you know, Sommer and people like that who've carried that team all the way with Petkovic. Petkovic has been a manager for, like 10 years or something. So it feels almost like this could be the last time we see them all together before there's some changes and newcomers and rotation. But they've got the experience. They've got really good players, Seferovic. I mean, they, this is a proper team.
You really like Seferovic, don't you?
I like Seferovic, he's not as prolific as he should be in terms of how much chances he gets and how many goals he scores. But on a good day, in a good tournament, he can easily score you 4 or 5.
I wonder what somebody like Remo Freuler, who's obviously been so good for Atalanta, what he can bring into this midfield. You know, he hasn't, for a guy, I think he's 29 now, he doesn't have as many caps as you would expect for a guy. He's a bit of a late bloomer, perhaps. Wales, you're making a face.
I have to talk nicely about them because of Mrs. Lawrence, so.
Clearly, the run-up to this to this tournament with, you know, you lose your manager and Ryan Giggs, who's not just your manager, he is one of the iconic figures of Welsh football, you know, because he's facing very serious criminal charges.
Yep.
And you can Google those if you like. You've got Bale, you know, who hasn't played very much the last couple of years. In and out, you always have the injury specter. Yep. You always have the injury specter with Aaron Ramsey.
Yep.
Those are probably their two most gifted players. It doesn't feel like we're going to get a rerun of 2016, does it?
I hope we do, because I think it was a wonderful story and the fans are great and Mrs. L was happy. It's just that Bale carried them for most of that Euro 2016. He carried them. He was amazing. I was at Lens for the game against England. I was in Lille for the game against Belgium. They were great. And I think once they started winning, they got that momentum, that confidence that they could beat anyone on their day, like they did with Belgium. Portugal was a step too high, but in the semis. But the problem is Bale is not the Bale that he was in 2016. Yeah. You know, he can have good moments, of course, and he might score goals, of course, but it's just not the same. So as much as it pains me to say, I think they will struggle certainly to do exactly the same that they did in 2016.
Well, it's a group B. Belgium are the number one ranked team in the world. They have pedigree as well. We saw how close they came to getting to the World Cup final 2 years ago. And, well, I say three years ago.
Yeah.
Technically, it's 2 years ago. It's really 3 years ago against Russia. In Russia. What I wonder, obviously, the issue for me is always the defense with Belgium.
You've said that before.
But I kind of feel Lukaku's had a monster season. That, I think, takes more pressure. I think he comes into the stronger than he has in any major tournament
at any
point in his career. Eden Hazard is a wild card, but the great thing is you don't need Eden Hazard. In other words, he's a bonus if he produces.
Yeah.
But you have enough other players,
That's true.
Obviously De Bruyne, but then we've got Mertens, you've got Doku,
Carrasco.
Yannick Carrasco, another one who's had a great season.
Yeah.
Yuri Tielemans, my player of the season.
Your players of the season.
And Witsel looks fit again, or fittish.
He won't play the first game.
In the middle of the park, but you'll get him back.
You will get him back.
But there's that, and you have a tremendous goalkeeper.
Yeah.
But there's that defense. Am I worried too much about this?
I think you are, maybe, because I think the back three, that's why they play back three, is because makes them more solid. You've got three instead of two. You've got Denier.
It's that simple, isn't it?
It's not that simple, but I think it's one of the reasons. And I think you're right to be worried. You're right to be worried about the fullbacks as well, because it's probably Thorgan Hazard who's going to play on the left-hand side, who's now a fullback, and then Meunier, who can't defend, or Castagne on the right-hand side. Castagne, I think, would be a better option. But they've got so much going forward anyway that even if you concede two, you can easily score three. Lukaku, as we saw against Croatia on Sunday night, he turns crumbs into like a feast. It was ridiculous. And I just think in that kind of form, he can perform so well, he can carry that team. The issue I have is not so much the injury of De Bruyne, who's going to miss the first game. Hazard, you just don't know. Witzel as well, I think he's a big worry. It's more, how much do you think psychologically the failures of the past, 2018 was a failure, because the way they lost against France in that semi-final, where they had a lot of the ball, didn't really know what to do with it.
You're basically saying that they should have done better.
Yeah.
Because they really were the best
team. And 2016 was really the...
Because they were really the best team in the world. Where the
they were not the best team
to
in
win.
The world.
Is that what you're saying?
They didn't deserve to go. But I think the way they handled that semi-final against France showed their limits to a certain extent.
Well, even before that, against Japan, when they nearly threw it away.
Yeah, exactly. And 2016 was even more, because it was Wales and maybe they were complacent. Martinez wasn't there. It was Wilmots. But still, I wonder how much this could have an impact psychologically on them once they get to the quarterfinals, of like, okay, we can't mess this up. The pressure, this is the golden generation. This is maybe the last chance. Well, certainly for Vermeulen, Vertonghen, Alderweireld probably. They're all 35, 32. Witzel is 32 as well. You know, Hazard is 31, De Bruyne has turned 30. So this is maybe the last chance they have all together to go to do something well. I don't know how psychologically they can cope with that pressure.
I think we both like Denmark. I look at this at the back. There's some really good defenders. Christensen, Simon Kjær, of course, coming off a great season at Milan. I don't think... I kind of giggle a little when people bring up Kasper Schmeichel in the same breath as his dad. I'm not 100% on. I'm not on Schmeichel bandwagon to the degree that others are, but he's still, I think, a very good goalkeeper.
Yep.
And then, you know, going forward at the other end, you've got. I'd be curious to know if people like Skov Larsen, people like Damsgaard, they have some really interesting, talented young players. I wonder, do they have a center forward that Christian Eriksen can set up? That's maybe my question.
Yeah, it would be Dahlberg or Poulsen. I mean, Braithwaite, we like Braithwaite, and he can play wide.
Poulsen, Braithwaite,
and
Dahlberg. You're talking about, I mean, certainly Poulsen and Braithwaite, they'll give you effort, but not much in the way of quality and goals.
Dahlberg's interesting.
You don't know what Dahlberg's going to show up.
Yeah, you're right. And this season with Nice, he was amazing at times, and then completely anonymous in other games. And you think, like, where is that inconsistency coming from? You know, why can't you just play at the same level all the time? But again, like you said, for Immobile or Belotti, on such a short competition, let's say 5-6 games, I mean, even more maybe if they go further, but Dahlberg can hit a proper good run of performances and goals. I don't know. He certainly has the talent, but this could be where they're just not good enough to go in the quarterfinals or the semifinal.
On paper, I think we both agree these two teams are substantially better than Russia and Finland. We'll get to Finland in a minute, but what gets me about Russia is I feel like we often underestimate them, and we often do so because most of these players play in Russia. They don't go abroad. We don't get to see as much as we should, especially if their teams don't perform well in European competition. And I think maybe that's part of the reason why in 2018 at the World Cup, you know, they got to the quarterfinals, if I recall correctly. Yeah, yeah. They knocked out Spain, albeit on penalties. But and every single Russian player, except for Cheryshev, was playing in Russia at the time.
Yeah.
Could they sneak up on us, or just looking at them, looking at what we've seen, looking at the results, do we just come see that this Russia side are substantially worse than the one we saw at the World Cup?
I don't know if they're worse, but certainly I think the momentum that they had in that World Cup is gone, even if they would play their games at St. Petersburg, and we haven't mentioned yet the home advantage that some of the countries will have, like Italy as well, of playing certainly the group stages games at, you know, in the home stadiums.
Hungary's going to have the biggest one. Hungary, 100% attendance, no restrictions.
How? Like, this is exceptional. But, you know, they don't have Soboslai, but they will have full stadium. So, yeah. Hey, you know, you lose one and you gain one. But I think that would be an advantage, certainly for Russia, than to do as well as they did in 2018. I don't think so. And Golovin, who has to be the key player for that team, has been so up and down with Monaco, not more because of injuries than anything else. But I don't know what kind of fitness is. I think he probably needs to be a bit sharper to have a proper impact on it.
I feel Golovin's kind of lost the last 3 years since moving to Monaco.
It's such a shame. And he's such a great player.
But what I wonder too is, I know Monaco had a lot of... He had a lot of competition for playing time, even when he was getting... It was one of those situations where, oh my God, our star player's injured. Let's rush him back out there.
Yeah.
But he just didn't play very much. I think he started 13 games last season for Monaco. And Miranchuk can also provide quality.
Yeah.
I just wonder, though, there is nobody like Golovin. And so if you're missing him, you got to go to plan B. And the plan B, when you have Artem Dzyuba up front, is... just try to batter the ball to Dzyuba, right?
Hoofing it, yeah. And crosses, I guess.
Which I think can make life difficult against some defenses.
Yeah.
But then I'm also thinking, if I'm Vertonghen and Alderweireld, I kind of say, all right, bring it. This we can handle.
Definitely,
this
yeah.
worries me less, exactly. than quick guys who can move.
Completely.
Finland, I'm assuming their defenders are also the size of buildings. So, yeah, I don't think it's a great setup for Russia. As for Finland, it's their first major
ever,
tournament.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. Teemu Pukki is inevitably... I don't follow the championship, but I did do research for this. He scored a bazillion goals again.
Yeah, of course.
In the championship.
Yeah, in the championship again.
How did he do
brilliant.
It?
He's just... I think it's maybe more of his level. No offense, Teemu, please. Don't get back at me. Then the Premier League, although he started so well that season, remember 2 years ago, and then just, you know, like, lost... You know, lost a bit of momentum, but I think again, you've got no pressure. You're like Iceland in 2016. People are excited for you because you've never been there. Glenn Kamara, Tim Sparv, those kind of players who have a lot of experience from club level in Europe, just go in and say, hey, listen, just enjoy it. Play our game. We're going to be a pain to play against. And then see what happens. And you just don't know. You could qualify as one of the best thirds. With 3 points, let's say, you know, one win and you're there against Russia, for example. You could beat Russia and then after that, see what happens. And then here you are, you know, it could be Northern Ireland in 2016 as well. I think for them, no pressure. Go there and enjoy it.
I think in some ways, the nature of this tournament where, you know, we're playing all these games to cut down from 24 to 16, right? You're going to get people like, oh, the quality's diluted and whatever. You know my views on this. I think that's absolute nonsense.
I
want to see these guys that I do
Me
not
too,
get to
completely.
See. I've been hearing about Tim Sparv for the last 10 years. Because as you know, Tim Sparv is a darling of the analytics community.
Of
like,
course.
Oh, Tim Sparv, right? He plays in Greece now, apparently.
Yeah.
You know, and yet, all I've gotten to see of him is the odd Europa League game and whatever. I'm curious to see how all of this comes together. Bring it on. There's not
of
long
course.
To go. I cannot wait.
Yeah.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Jules, it's crossover time in the sense that we're going to cross over from football on this side of the Atlantic to the other side of football to the NFL. Because we're joined by George Atala, who is the assistant executive director of the NFL Players Association, which is the players' union over there. George, Welcome aboard. You're also a big Arsenal fan. We should point this out. And you're a big football fan in general. So I want to get a sense from you about the differences in terms of governance, in terms of setup. People talk a lot about US owners coming over here, trying to monetize the sport, the role of the unions, and in general, how we experience sports. And it seems to me that in many ways, we're really talking about apples and oranges because there's very deep differences.
Yeah, well, we've been a labor union here in the United States for almost 65 years, and the NFL Players Union, you know, does its job of representing the nearly 2,500 active NFL players. We have a different system, different model, as you've, you know, suggested, with respect to how we share revenue with management, how our clubs are run, the legal issues that we have with U.S. labor law, which, you know, over the last several decades has eroded in terms of protecting labor. So we have a little bit of a tougher job when it comes to litigation, which is why we put a lot of emphasis on how we do our collective bargaining agreements. And obviously, we've just come off of a collective bargaining agreement in March of 2020 that governs everything from how many hours players can be at the facility to how they get their medical records and how we split up the nearly $16 billion revenue pie that is generated on an annual basis. So I think from what I've learned in my role over the last 10, 12 years is our emphasis is much greater on the collective bargaining agreement than relying on labor laws of the United States.
So there is no collective bargaining agreement in football and on this side of the pond. And maybe there should be. One of the reasons that's often cited is that players' unions over here, who I think it's fair to say are generally far weaker than the NFL players' union or the NBA one. One of the reasons is that they said, look, we look after all professional footballers, from the guys who, you know, are making a couple hundred dollars a week to the people who are making substantial amounts and who play a bigger role in the top division. And in the NFL, correct me if I'm wrong, George, is it in some ways easier because you don't have to deal with lower division players who might have different interests, different things? So, for example, when you talk about cutting down the number of games, the people in the NFL can generally make a living playing 16 or now going up to 17 games a season. A lower division player in Europe might be like, well, if you cut my games, you're going to cut my revenue and I'm not going to be able to pay my mortgage. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think we have different challenges. I mean, structurally, obviously, we don't have four leagues to look after, right? So, or four divisions to look after. So that makes it slightly easier. On the other hand, the turnover in our sport, we turn over roughly 25% of our membership every year. So when you think about how many players have to go through an education process about what the union does for them, how we engage with them in terms of working hours, wages, working conditions, wages, hours, all of that stuff, that's a different challenge. So we do have a disparity in our membership as well. We have minimum salary guys, and then you've got Gab, your favorite player, Aaron Rodgers, at the other end of the spectrum, who make different salary than our minimum salary guys. So we do have different structural challenges. But certainly we do not have the governing over four leagues and lower divisions where stadiums are barely packed and revenue is a challenge. We certainly don't have that.
Are you surprised, George, that football players in Europe are not as well structured with a union, and I mean a meaningful, like a powerful one, than they are in the US, whether it's in, as we said, basketball or American football? Are you surprised that in Europe maybe the players haven't felt the need or that there's not a better structure around them?
I think I'm hesitant to provide criticism because they do have some labor laws that protect them. And I have seen some labor action in the last couple of years, or at least in the last 5 years in Spain, for example, where as soon as the athletes make a threat to not play, everything sort of changes, right? Everybody gets their attention. So I do think that they have different tools that they use in Europe. And also, I think you guys cover the sport on a daily basis. Jules, you know, every club team, especially at the top level, whether it's the Premier League or Serie A or in France in Ligue 1, it's comprised of athletes from all different parts of the world. So you don't have that uniform continuity in terms of where the players are coming from. They have different experiences. A lot of them are trying to make it at the club level, despite what their salaries are. And then obviously you do have something that I've been open about, the agent problem. Sometimes the agents have a lot more power in European football than they do on this side of the ocean.
All right, let's stick with this issue of agents, because it just does my head in how even today people don't seem to understand, football fans in Europe don't seem to understand how it works over here with agents versus agents in U.S. sports and really in most other sports. So let me make an analogy here, right? So Tom Brady, his contract with the New England Patriots is up. This is just over a year ago. He becomes a free agent. He can sign with any team. Now, correct me if I'm wrong here. His agent, a man named Don Yee, and his company, they go. He ends up signing for Tampa Bay and signs whatever the salary is. Don Yee negotiates the salary on Tom Brady's behalf. And then Tom Brady pays Don Yee a service fee, a percentage, or whatever it is he pays him. And Tom Brady goes and pays him.
Yeah.
Now, if the rules of football on this side of the pond had existed in the NFL, this is what would have happened. Don Yee would have gone around to a bunch of different clubs, might have still negotiated Tom Brady's salary. Tom Brady would have taken the salary. And then Don Yee would have been paid by the club for delivering Tom Brady.
Yeah.
So Tampa Bay might have said, "Oh, we'll pay you $10 million bucks for bringing us Tom Brady." And maybe, you know, Cleveland, somebody else would have said, "We'll pay you $20 million," which to me is just an evident conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Now, just to be clear, George, in the NFL, this doesn't happen. Your union members who have agents pay their agents, and their agents work for them. As far as we know, there are no club owners going, and there's no Jerry Jones doesn't go and like bring an envelope full of cash and give it to Dak Prescott's agent so you'll sign a new deal, right? Is this fair?
Yeah, that is a fair statement. That's absolutely a fair statement. And the NFL Players Union, one of the roles that we have in protecting players, we have an entire agent regulation system that is implemented and refreshed almost every year. And the oversight comes from our player board, right? So it regulates everything from marketing advances to what the commission can be, to how they can engage, to who they can represent.
This is the players union.
No,
this is the players union that regulates the agents.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So if I want to get my cousin Vinny, who just got out of prison, to go on fraud charges, to go and represent me, the union might have a problem with that. You might tell me I can't do that.
Yeah, you couldn't do that. No.
Especially if
you could not do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is extraordinary. Right. We don't have this in football.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, okay, what are our player unions doing? Are they even part of the conversation of regulating agents?
I don't think so, no.
All right. I just find that extraordinary. One other big thing, obviously, perhaps the biggest kind of non-on-the-page story of our lifetimes was the Super League, the aborted creation of the Super League. And in popular narrative, this is driven by greedy American owners, especially ones like the Glazers, who also happen to own a football club. What I was never clear on with this, and they weren't clear on, is the Super League says we generate more money than anybody else. We bring more revenue, and then we have to divide that revenue with UEFA and with smaller, lesser clubs. In U.S. sports, I'm sure the Lakers, or even though they skeeve me a little bit, the Dallas Cowboys could come out and say, we have more fans, we generate more revenue. Why should we share with the Green Bay Packers or the Sacramento Kings, depending on your sport? That doesn't happen. That's not part of the conversation. Has it ever been part of the conversation? Does it ever get threatened? Does anybody ever bring this up?
No, but again, we're talking about a system that has 32 teams. It's defined we know how much revenue comes into the system every year because of our collective bargaining agreement. And there's never been sort of a, but you know, every year Sportico publishes the most valuable franchises in the NFL. There's never been sort of a playoff breakaway Cowboys, Packers, Washington, and Giants, right? There's never been sort of a threat to do that. The NFL is the NFL. You know, I also want to take a little bit of a poke at the narrative of the American owners are breaking away. Last I checked, there were only three more teams, non-American owned, who are still dreaming of the Super League. And I think it's Juve, Barca, and Real Madrid, right? Non-American owned clubs. So, I mean, on one hand, I was less offended with the concept because sort of sports of the United States, I'm used to this. Maybe I'm cynical, but I'm used to this. Anything that we can do to get an extra buck or make an extra buck, that's sort of how our ownerships, we've learned how they run their businesses. So I was slightly less offended by it. But I also appreciate, you know, the fact that it was just a cockamamie plan from the beginning. that was clumsy and really never going to gain traction given the dynamics in Europe. So we've never had that threat. I don't think we actually will ever have that threat.
But for example, if let's say something like that happened in the US with an NFL, or there's another league created that has happened before and even now. And I don't know, one of the, or so some of the current franchises wants to join another American football league in North America. You would be at the heart of that talk. They will have to meet with you. They will have to have the consentment, I guess, of the players, or certainly some of the players that you represent in those franchises, to be able to. They could not vote about a breakaway league by themselves without having not you involved in it.
That's correct, Jules. That's absolutely right. And the players' union, one of the roles that we play, you know, we have had other leagues try to pop up over the last several years. The XFL, most famously, which is still trying to get themselves back up and running, right? So they do approach us. They do. There was talk a couple of years ago about a development league in the NFL, and our role is primarily to tell those leagues and the clubs that are trying to start up, you know, there's a baseline for all of the things we started off the top of the program with: the health and safety protocols, revenue sharing, working conditions, all of the things that we try to push in our collective bargaining agreement. Those are things that we advocate for, you know, across the board. And you know, whether it's other leagues that are starting up or other sports unions who come to us and lean on us for advice and we collaborate with, that's the spirit that we try to operate in.
There's a lawsuit right now that's been filed with the European courts by the three clubs that are still in the Super League, Juventus, Barcelona, and Real Madrid. And they make the point that the UEFA, in running the Champions League, is a monopolist because they're a competition organizer, they're a regulator, they're a governing body. They're all those things in one, and that's a monopolistic argument. You probably have more of a legal background than I do. I believe in the U.S., there's an antitrust exemption for baseball because baseball is the national pastime, and you know, there's a Supreme Court ruling on this. That's not the case for the NFL or the NBA. So I'm assuming the U.S. Basketball Association, that's affiliated to FIBA, really doesn't have much jurisdiction over the NBA in the same way. I don't even know if there is a federation of American football, if there is such a thing, I forgive my ignorance, they don't have jurisdiction over the NFL. Is that an accurate picture here?
Yeah, I think it's just a much different system. So the antitrust laws in the United States protect the athletes to a point. And one of the things that we did in 2011, we tested that antitrust exemption in the NFL when the players voted to not be part of a union anymore. So you have to sort of remove yourself from being a union so that each individual athlete becomes an independent contractor, therefore pushing the clubs and the league away from that antitrust protection. It is a different system. That decision in 2011 was split, And the U.S. courts, not to get too far down the political spectrum, but it is rather interesting that, again, over the last several decades, the courts have taken a far more pro-management view of labor issues than in the early 40s and 50s and even early 60s in the United States. So, again, the emphasis for us is on how we protect athletes in our collective bargaining agreements. We have a robust, nearly 400-page collective bargaining agreement that literally you guys can't, if you guys were NFL players, you couldn't walk into the Eagles facility without having some page of that CBA govern what you were going to do on that day. So we take a lot of pride in the detail that we negotiate for our members. And if we have to use the courts, we will. But one of the challenges that we have is the courts have become more pro-management over the course of the last several decades.
One of the big issues that obviously last summer with a lot of things that happened, I guess, off the field and in the real world that we all live in, you had the George Floyd passing. It was his anniversary recently. You had a lot of protests, and it felt like the beginning of kind of that movement with athletes being more vocal to speak. Obviously, they've always spoken out historically.
Yeah.
But we've seen it in sports. We've seen Premier League clubs, their players choosing to take a knee. That began in the NFL. There was some pushback. Some people suggest it was bad for business and so on. I'm assuming there is there's a whole spectrum of views in your players' union. And am I right in saying you decided to say, we're not going to take a position as a union beyond defending people's right to express themselves? We're not going to tell all our members that, you know, we all expect you to kneel. You're going to do what you think is right. Is that pretty much accurate? Can you talk a little bit about how you approached it, perhaps versus the way it was done here, where, you know, in theory, people could choose not to kneel, and some people, like Wilfred Zaha, eventually decided not to kneel, but for different reasons. It was pretty much unthinkable that, especially any Premier League player who's not a player of color, was not going to kneel before games. I mean, in the real world. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think you mentioned Zaha and what he's done at Crystal Palace, and is just tremendous, and using his voice and using his platform to talk about these issues in a thoughtful way. I actually look to a lot of our athletes in the United States beyond just the NFL. WNBA players have done a tremendous job in using their voice. U.S. women's soccer team has done a tremendous job in using their voice and their platform to talk about these issues thoughtfully. So I think where you're right in that our job from the beginning is to protect their right to express themselves in the workplace. And we've effectively done that. So players can choose whether or not they want to demonstrate, however they want to demonstrate, whether it's a fist, a knee, using their social media, whatever it is. That's something that we've done to protect them. But again, U.S. dynamics, different than European dynamics. France has its own racial challenges. Italy, Spain, the U.K. So there are much different dynamics over in Europe that we're seeing come to light. And I think we all have to come together. One of the things that we're most proud of actually is our affiliation with a lot of the international sports unions, and how we've been able to collaborate with a little bit with the PFA on this. But, you know, I mentioned our relationship with the WNBA Players Association, the U.S. Women's National Team Players Association, and how they use their voice and their platform for this. The bigger issue, Gab, you said is absolutely spot on. It's about real life. And a lot of us watch sports because we're mesmerized. And, you know, I'm a fan because I'm mesmerized by the athletes and all the stuff that they do. And I have a passion for sports. If we can learn anything from the last year, is that we do put a lot of pressure on the athletes to make a demonstration or have these issues come to light, or bring these issues come to light, right? And we as a society often react to what they're doing. I think where we are now is we have to evolve past that point and follow their lead and actually do something to join them and make change. That's really the Pollyanna-ish hopeful side of me, is that we look at what's going on, Marcus Rashford, Raheem Sterling. I mean, the list goes on and on of abuse that players have taken, and we all have to take a stand against it. And again, we're proud to have played a small role in that.
Historically, we're going to bring it back a little bit to football on this side of the pond. Historically, there was the idea of the club owner who maybe was happy to lose money or just to break even in football. That's kind of been the figure. If he lost money, he almost treated it as like almost like philanthropy. Maybe he'd gain respect or in some cases political power. But there wasn't a sense that anybody owns a football club to actually make money.
Like a business, yeah.
Now, that's changed a little bit. That's obviously not the ethos of U.S. owners in U.S. sports, because they're set up differently, as you said. And when they come over here, I mean, the Glazers, of course, also own an NFL franchise. They've been hammered left, right, and center because they want to make money off their club and have made money off their club. You're an Arsenal fan. You have a guy who, your owner Stan Kroenke, also owns an NFL team. He's a businessman, right? He wants to make money too.
Of course.
Do you square those two things? I mean, let me ask you straight up. Would you be happier if Sheikh Mansour owned your club from a fan perspective? But you told me to ask the difficult questions here.
No. But I think I'd be happy if we had an owner who was willing to do. I mean, it's like same question if you asked me if I was happy if Roman Abramovich owned Arsenal, right? Like, it's, do I want a billionaire owner who's putting his own money into the club to buy the best players in the world? Yeah, of course. Okay. Like, why wouldn't I want a club owner who's doing everything that he could to with a passion to win? Of course I want that. I think that's not a shot at the Kroenkes per se. I mean, certainly they've had their challenges and I'm open to talking about that, but each club has to, you know, and just being a fan of the Premier League, each club has its own identity, right? I think modern day Premier League fans look at Manchester City as a juggernaut, whereas most people in the UK remember that they were a fledgling, you know, side, oftentimes mid-table for such a long time, right? So I don't think fans are naive to the fact that there's money in football and you have to spend to win these days. What I have a hard time with is the title settled before it starts? That's what I have a hard time with. And yes, Arsenal claim to be a big club. Yes, we have resources at our disposal. Of course, the pandemic has hit, you know, every single Premier League club in the same way. But if we claim to have resources, if we claim to have a big club, man, should we be investing in the same way? As a fan, I certainly would like to see us go for it this transfer window. But I just don't know what the appetite is to do what Abramovich and Mansour have done, or some of the other clubs that have, you know, ownership groups with unlimited resources.
If there was something you could bring from the NFL to European football here, and let's say to bring into the top five leagues in Europe, what would it be? Would it be a salary cap? Would it be a cap on how much money you can spend on transfers in every transfer window? Would it be, I don't know, would it be a drive style of recruitment? If there was one thing that you could take with you, what would it be?
I think it would be two things, and I've thought about this quite a bit, actually. I'd like to see better health and safety protections for the athletes. And I think, let's just take the most glaring one, which is the concussion protocols.
Yeah.
I still don't think there are strong concussion protocols across European football. And that really bothers me. And
Are you suggesting that there's something slightly wrong with somebody getting whacked on the head and he goes to see the club doctor who's employed by the club and he holds up two fingers and then the guy goes back on the field?
Sometimes
it's just one going back and forth. That these guys don't seek independent medical advice? I mean,
yes, I do think there's something wrong with that. And I mean, I don't want to make light of it, but every time I watch and somebody gets their head hit and they go off to the side and they throw some water in their head. And I mean, that would be, you know, one of the primary things there is a better health and safety protocol across European football. And then the second one is something we touched on earlier, which is the agent regulation issue, which I think is starting to change a little bit, but to, you know, and maybe it's underreported and maybe you guys can touch on it more as you keep going. These massive transfer fees that are being exchanged, how much of it is the player really seeing? And how much of it is the agent really controlling? And that to me is a bigger problematic issue with the stuff that we talk about with money in football, right? Like, where's the money really going, and are the athletes really benefiting from their success?
All right, enough, George. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, Gab.
Ronald Koeman will be in charge at Barcelona next season. Jules, considering the radio silence, I guess this was inevitable, but you must be happy from your face.
I'm
you're
so happy. It's going to be another fun season with Ronald Koeman at the helm. You know, let's see what he comes up with this time.
It doesn't matter if you're happy. It matters if Lionel Messi is happy.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much Messi is happy. I'm not sure how the fan base is happy either. I'm even not sure how Laporta is happy, because clearly Koeman was not the first choice. This is by default that he's still there.
They haven't been linked with anybody else, so I assume.
I know, but they still
they
tried.
They can't afford anybody
looked.
Else, maybe.
Maybe they can't afford anybody else. But it's like that tweet that Koeman's agent put out saying, like, oh, yeah, let's get married, but let's wait for 2 weeks if I can find a better groom or a better bride. Yeah, well, they could not find a better groom or bride, so they kept Koeman. Tottenham have stopped their pursuit of Antonio Conte. Gab, was it about the salary or the budget or the number of staff he could bring in, or maybe the fact they just couldn't afford him, full stop?
Look, I mean, as always happens when these things break apart, and by the way, like, just to, my understanding is Fabio Paratici still on track to become director of football, not confirmed yet. I think that this deal is frozen for now. I don't think it is 100% dead, but right now they've stopped talking and they're going to look at other options. I refuse to believe that it was about his salary or his staff, because you should know how much Antonio Conte is going to demand.
Surely.
He's going to always demand a ton of money, because that's how he rolls, and he thinks he's worth it, and others think he's worth it too. So going in there and trying to negotiate when you said, oh, no, wait, how much money you want? Equally with his staff. That's the one thing. He'd rather compromise on his salary than on his staff. I don't get this weird obsession. It's the only country where you hear it in, like, oh, what? Yeah, well, you can only bring 2 staff members, 3 staff members, 5 staff members. You're paying the guy $15 million or whatever. Let him bring the dudes that he wants.
Yeah.
Take it out of his salary, which is what people have done in the past. You know, these guys, these assistants make like 50-80K a year. They're not the ones who are going to bankrupt you. So I assume it's down to budget and him thinking, you know, it was reported today, obviously the Spurs version of events, that he wanted £100 million to spend, you know, net spend this summer. That's what he was expecting, and that's not possible. I understand it's not possible. That is the only valid reason, I think, or the main valid reason why this shouldn't go further once you've spoken to him. England beat Romania 1-0. Jules, still no City and no Chelsea players in the squad because they're all tired from the Champions League final.
Yeah.
A ton of rotation, people like Godfrey in there, who we don't think is going to go to the Euros.
Wait, I can tell you, we definitely don't know going.
Did you learn anything from this game?
You know what I learned, and I think it's a shame, and I'm not Southgate, I don't like Southgate, I don't think he's very good.
You like him as a person.
As a person, but as a manager. But I feel for him in the sense that he's had 2 friendly matches to prepare for these Euros, which is a big Euros. It's a home. It's on home soil for England pretty much the whole way, if they go to the final. And yet he hasn't been able to play his...
Zero preparation.
Yeah, his best 11. Not even the best back four, not even the best front three.
Not even in training.
Nothing. And I just think there's a point where... Even if whether you like him or not, this is not ideal by far. And I just feel for him a bit.
And I think this is an underreported story. People say, oh, you want to get the excuses in early? Yeah, I'll say this is a fair excuse, Gareth Southgate.
Yeah.
It's a fair excuse that you can make. I haven't had time to do my job as England manager. It's not anybody's fault, but you need to give it to him.
Completely. And I think defensively, they still looked a bit dodgy in that game against Romania. A Romania team that is not very good and yet played well, and Sam Johnstone made some big saves in goal. And also in that game, Gab, Jordan Henderson pulls rank on Dominic Calvert-Lewin, took England's second penalty and missed it. That was a bit weird.
It was very weird. Apparently, like, you know, I was watching on television, the commentator said, oh, and Jordan Henderson has never scored in 56 games for England, so maybe that's why he wants to take the penalty to get his confidence back. I don't know, but dude, if you're not the penalty taker, Ward-Prowse and Rashford were ahead of him in the pecking order. Neither one was on the pitch.
Yeah.
I'm assuming Southgate's pecking order goes further than just two names, and Henderson not supposed to take it. Just really bad optics.
Really strange.
Going over and taking the ball from him. I mean, I'm sorry. Who are you? Like, you know, sorry, but you're still Jordan Henderson, right?
Yeah.
Either agree this beforehand with the manager, or don't do it.
Look at the bench once the penalty is there. And Sadiq, we said, give it to Calvert-Lewin or give it to Grealish or give it to so-and-so. I don't care. But don't do it on your own.
Jules, more booing of players taking a knee from the fans and two Romanian players refusing to take the knee and coming out and saying, we were making a statement by not taking the knee.
Yeah. I mean, I'm more upset by the Middlesbrough crowd or some of them and those idiots who boo their own players for doing it than the Romanian players. As we've said, it should come to individual decision anyway. We've always said it, Gab, and I think that's fair. But the booing, I just don't get it. And maybe if you booed, you're part of the reason why they're taking the knee.
Yeah. All right. Again, you know my thoughts is I'm not going to go into them. One of the Romanian players, Stanciu, saying that it was out of solidarity to Andrei Kudela, of course, was involved in.
Yeah.
He was banned for 10 days. For 10 games.
Yeah.
10 games by UEFA. On the balance of probabilities rather than kind of beyond the burden of reasonable doubt, which, you know, obviously annoys a lot of players.
Yeah.
He's entitled to his view, I suppose.
More snipping between Juventus president Andrea Agnelli and UEFA president Alexander Seferin. Sniping. Agnelli says the Super League wasn't a coup d'etat, but rather a cry for help that was so badly needed. And Seferin says that he's dead to him, considering he's the godfather of one of his children.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad.
Obviously, this is very, very personal. I don't think Seferin helps himself when he says stuff like that.
I know, he should stop. I mean, that was a soft food interview.
Disappointed in it. Equally, I'm sorry, Agnelli's saying this is a cry for help and, you know, UEFA wasn't listening. Come on, man. Come on. You're on the UEFA Executive Committee. You're the president of the European Clubs Association, right? Why don't you come out and tell me what you did to fix things from the inside? Also, why don't you come out and address the fact that, I go back to this, the entire system was profitable for 2 years before the pandemic hit. Why don't you go out and explain that rather than saying it's a cry for help? He doesn't look good in this.
No, definitely not.
Sergio Busquets tests positive for COVID. Spain have to go into self-isolation. They'll play the under-21s in their next friendly. George, this is a warning. This is to be taken seriously of what could happen.
Yeah, and I think that's more of a warning than the Scotland case that we had. Remember John Flegg the week before, and some players had to self-isolate as well. But this is so close to the tournament, the start of the tournament.
What if this happens during the tournament?
Yeah, it'd be the same. And now, how do you know that some of these Spain players who now have tested negative, because Busquets is the only one amongst the 51 squad and staff to have tested positive, but who knows that in 2-3 days maybe more players will test positive as well, and then it's an absolute shambles and a mess. And also for Luis Enrique, players will have to train on their own now. You can't have collective training sessions, which is a nightmare when you prepare for Euros like this. So it's definitely what Spain needed, but it's certainly, like you said, a warning and a reminder to all the teams and all the fans that this could happen very much now and during the competition as well.
All we can do is keep our fingers crossed.
Exactly. The USA win a dramatic CONCACAF Nations League final against Mexico, who missed a last-minute penalty. Gab, what does this mean? And how big is this for the US?
I think it's obvious it's a big boost to morale. When you're the US or Mexico, the only serious team that you're going to play in these is basically each other.
Yeah,
right? It just happens that
usually,
way.
Usually,
And so it's a big win. It's on home soil. I don't think it was the greatest performance from the U.S., but they gutted it out. And it was dramatic, and it was on television, and it gets the bandwagon rolling, and there's a piece of silverware. And, you know, all of these things build that positive momentum for what is a very talented young generation of players. Paris Saint-Germain, but big boss, Nasser Al-Khelaifi. Oh, look, you're cheering Nasser Al-Khelaifi. How great.
Of course I am. He's my chairman.
He says Kylian Mbappe won't be sold and won't leave Paris Saint-Germain at the end of his contract either. So, Jules, given that his contract expires next summer, I'm assuming he's trying to say that Mbappe has secretly signed a lifetime extension. What's he going to do? Like, keep him in a cage in his basement? Like, what?
I don't know. Maybe. Or maybe he just meant, you know, now he's not going to leave on a free because we're going to extend his contract. He said that the talks were progressing well in the rest of the interview. I believe him. I believe every word he says. He can tell me, like, jump through the window in the third floor. I would do it. Maybe not. But I like that he's positive. He's still not done. And Mbappe still hasn't extended his contract, so he could well live on a free in a year time.
But Nasser says it won't happen.
Exactly. So.
So
for now, we have to believe him. And then if it happens, then we can say, oh, Nasser, remember that interview you gave to L'Équipe a year ago? Then, you know, that doesn't look good now. Felix Nemtschaa scores the only goal as Germany beat Portugal 1-0 to win the under-21 Euros. Gab, would they be better off maybe sending the under-21s then to the Euros instead of Yogi Löw in the first team?
That's unkind. Ah. Have some respect,
Hey, I'm
Jules.
Just saying. They were underdogs before. No one thought they could win it. It's not a great generation. Apart from Florian Wirtz, it's not a great generation. And hey, look.
Yeah, this is. I think Portugal kind of threw this away, actually. They were the better team. They're possibly the best team in the tournament.
100%.
France possibly is the most talented team. But hey, it's another win. Germany now have won two of the last three Euro under-21s. Pressure continues to mount to postpone the Copa America. Jules.
That's right, Gab. I mean, Argentina said on Sunday night that they were in, but certainly in Brazil, who are now hosting it, a lot of the players and Chichi, probably as well, would rather it not being played, certainly even on home soil. So there's a lot of discontent amongst the players and the teams about this Copa America.
A number of politicians weighing in as well, saying against it.
Yeah, all of that. So when you should be so much looking forward to it. It's such a great competition, as you said. You've covered it twice. You went there. It's so good, and yet we're here a week before it starts, just going like, oh, maybe it should not happen, or who wants it to play? It should not be like this.
I think one of the keys is I believe Brazil have one more game on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I think they said that the players are going to come out and then express their views after that. So I think, you know, that's one to watch.
Belgium beat Croatia 1-0 on Sunday night, and Gab, Romelu Lukaku was on fire.
Yeah, I'm going to use a term coined by my old colleague, Rory K. Smith, which is a striker who is not supply dependent. If you watch that Romelu Lukaku goal, it's all him. It's all him. Back to goal, boom, defends the ball, creates space, shoots. It's unbelievable. He's just in the form of his life right now, and really has been for a long time. Kevin De Bruyne, more Belgians, man, what is this? Has won the PFA Player of the Year. Jules, we both had Ruben Dias, but given the timing of this award, in fact, I might say given the nature of this award, but does anybody care?
Not so sure. Even KDB himself, I mean, he was having a surgery on his eye that, you know, obviously Rudiger smashed. So I'm not sure if he cared. I thought Ruben Dias had won it, to be honest. I knew Ruben Dias had won the Footballer's Writer award, and you and I, you know, would have voted for him for the PFA Player of the Year as well. But is KDB, yeah, of course he deserves it. He's one of the best in the world. But I still think Ruben Dias was not injured through the whole season, had such an incredible impact that it could have easily won it too.
The PFA, for those who don't know, is a Footballers Union here in England. This award is voted on by the players. I think it's a pretty dysfunctional organization. They're getting new leadership coming in, I think, at the end of this month. They're going to have a lot of things on their plate to fix. I think the Player of the Year award should be at the top of their agenda.
Yeah. Thomas Tuchel and Thiago Silva both extend their contract with Chelsea, which is not a surprise, Gab, at all.
Yeah, I think Tuchel's extension was automatic based on
top four qualification or something.
Either that or then he won the Champions League. You knew he was going to get it. He's locked in through 2024, which, by the way, another thing, I like it when clubs don't give managers mega long contracts. And I think Chelsea are doing the right thing here. You know, obviously it's 3 years from now, but he just won the Champions League. Makes sense. Thiago Silva, another year. It's not going to hurt you. It's going to help. I think maybe still could use another defender at the back.
Yeah, I think so too.
Chelsea have triggered the option to extend Olivier Giroud's contract for another season. But Jules, it doesn't necessarily mean he's staying, does it?
You're right, Gab. And right now, I think he would say that he would rather go. And I think he likes the idea of going to Italy, to Milan. And the fact that contract was extended, which was only the club's decision. It was a clause in the contract.
It was a club option.
A club option. They could trigger it by themselves without asking Giroud his opinion or if he wanted to or not. But we will see, Gabby, how it develops on the Tammy Abraham front, on signing another striker front. And then I think the door could open for him, whether there's a fee, a very small fee, or not a fee at all. But I think right now he would rather leave and go somewhere where he knows he will play more.
I think this is insurance. I think it's insurance for both of them. Because I think Chelsea would have no issue of letting him go outside the Premier League on a free.
Yeah.
Equally, Chelsea have to figure out, are we going to sign a big striker this summer? And if so, what kind of big striker do we want to sign? And can we sign one? I think rather than signing a middling striker, I think you're better off, if worse comes to worse, keep Giroud for another season,
yeah,
because you'd get him the playing time and then save your resources to go after, you know, the really big striker you want next year.
Yeah.
I think that could be a better option.
Yeah, maybe. Duncan Ferguson reportedly turned down the chance to joining Carlo Ancelotti's staff at Real Madrid. So does that mean, Gab, that he will get the Everton job?
Reportedly, he'd love to manage, and I think he loves Everton, and so obviously this is a team he'd love.
And he was interim manager, doing quite a good job before Carlo arrived.
Yeah, I think it would have been really cool to see him prowling the sidelines. Seriously, like I don't think there's been as menacing an assistant on the sidelines for any club in Spain since Mono Burgos.
Yeah, probably.
Of course, left Simeone.
Yeah.
Although Simeone is pretty scary himself when he wants to be. But no, I do know for a fact that, you know, Carlo has nothing but great things to say about Duncan Ferguson, about the role, about the relationship the two struck up, which, you know, on paper so different. Although there's that great video of Duncan Ferguson going to hug Carlo, I don't know if it was at the Merseyside Derby or some game, and Carlo just sort of being terrified at this giant going, potentially crushing him.
Yeah.
Holland beat Georgia 3-0. And it could have been four if Memphis hadn't missed a penalty. Now, who's laughing at Frank de Boer now, Jules?
I still am. Memphis Depay is the only good thing right now in that team. Matisse de Ligt got injured. De Boer is still playing in that three at the back stupid formation. And they beat Georgia. They were only 1-0 up at halftime, by the way. But our friend Scored the second goal with an assist by Memphis again. But Memphis is the only good thing right now that they have. If he stays on this form with him, you don't know what can happen for the Netherlands. And I really hope that he can play like this, because he deserves a big tournament. And then going to next season, whether that's Barcelona or another top club. But
is it too obvious to play Wout Weghorst with a winger either side and let Depay come in from the flank? Is that just too obvious a solution?
I don't think so, but only if you were working on things. You know, some players in a half space, you leave the channel for your right wing backs or left wing backs or whatever to put crosses in. I think there could be a way, but not with that manager, unfortunately for them. Wojciech Szczęsny says he's had no contact with other clubs and no contact from Juventus either, which makes me think, Gab, that maybe they won't be signing Giorgio Donnarumma then.
I told you it was always going to be difficult given the length of Szczęsny's contract, given his wages. I don't think Szczęsny has any reason to lie about this.
No.
That nobody's gone to him and says, hey, look, we might be signing Gigio, you know, and start laying the groundwork to move to another club. It's not something you need to keep secret at this stage. So if nobody's told him anything, what it suggests to me is that unless Juve are planning to do things uber secretly and maybe wait until the end of August, I think it's going to be down to Donnarumma to go and find himself a club. We've talked many times. We've applauded Milan for holding firm on Donnarumma. You seemed to say on the FC show the other night that the Paris Saint-Germain door is closing. Yeah. Keylor Navas
says
extension as well, right?
Yeah.
And he's been linked to Barcelona, but again Barcelona, what do you do with Ter Stegen? Right?
I know.
Right now, as much as I love Gigio, Ter Stegen is a better goalkeeper. This makes zero sense. I wonder if it's going to end up with him maybe signing a one-year contract at a so-called friendly club just to play, and then we go through this whole thing a year from now.
Wow, imagine.
But yeah, you got to wonder about this kid's mindset.
Yeah.
Speaking of free agents, who could be in Paris next season?
Yeah.
Let's talk. Gini Wijnaldum. But please tell me now that we know what we know about Koeman, is he really getting away from Barcelona?
Yeah.
How?
And I will tell you more, the call from Mauricio Pochettino played the big part. Of course, the money, the PSG doubling is the wages offer that Barca gave him is a big thing, of course. He will earn twice more in Paris. But the call from Poch certainly played a big part in convincing him to join PSG and not Barcelona. So I don't know what Koeman said or did or whatever, but
I'm sorry,
they had this in the bag.
this is a facepalm situation. And this Crazy. Is, we can't just blame everything on Koeman, right? Because I think this is where the club has to take some responsibility. Because we said this before, when we were talking about Koeman earlier, they may have had another list of other managers that they were considering.
Yeah.
But the fact, but they haven't been speaking to anybody for the past 3 weeks, right? Yeah. It seems to me like they just took for granted that Gini Wijnaldum was going to come. Why not lock him in earlier?
Exactly.
Right. Even if there's going to be somebody else, it's not like you're signing like a pile of turds. You're signing Gini Wijnaldum on a free transfer.
Exactly.
Lock it in before.
PSG had been talking to his agent, and they just waited for Barca to make their offer, and then had a look at the offer and could clearly offer more and make a bigger call for it. And I think they did. And I think. I know he's 30 and he will, you know, and I know he's over the edge of 30, Gab, and you don't like that. And it's a 3-year deal and it's worth a lot of money. But I think because he's a freak of nature physically, you're taking less risk with someone like him than maybe another 30-year-old midfielder or something. He's going to be a machine for them.
Maybe Barcelona can take one of Paris Saint-Germain's overpaid aging midfielders on loan.
Yes, so we've got Herrera, if you want, Draxler, Sarabia, Ganagay, anything you want, Laporta, Koeman.
Not Verratti, though, right?
No, Verratti. Verratti you can't touch. Report in England saying that Manchester United could sign Kieran Trippier. Remember, we talked a little bit about it on Monday, who has just 1 year left on his contract at Atletico Madrid, and for £15 million. Gab, that's a decent amount of money.
It's a decent amount of money. It's a reasonable price for Manchester United. If I'm United, I wonder, can I try to drive the price down even lower? I mean,
yeah,
they do have a lot of money.
Or something, yeah.
He's got a year left. You know, why not?
Yeah, why not?
But if Trippier arrives, Jules, that could mean Aaron Wan-Bissaka moving to centre back. Would this make sense?
I think that's an idea that Solskjaer and his staff had for quite a long time now, considering he can't play football, really, with the ball, I mean. He can't cross the ball. He can't. But as centre back, you don't need to do crosses. You know, you can. And he's so solid defensively, so solid in one on one, so quick as well. Maybe it could be good for him.
I think the idea is that because he's not 6'3", you know, can he play central defence?
But of course he can.
It's not that big. You're not going to face that many crosses. You don't face that many crosses during open play anyway, yep. Right? If you're a good leaper, if you're smart, you can still defend a header. On set pieces, you can put some other big dude on there, move Matic back there or Cavani or whatever.
McTominay, yeah,
you know, McTominay. So, yeah, I think this would be an interesting one. I think it'd also give you an option should they decide to go back three as well. Yep. I think that could be a solution, which you might want to do with Trippier because, of course, Trippier has defensive issues, as
yeah,
we know.
Yeah. Inter president Steven Zhang confirmed that the club will be belt tightening this summer. It's not a surprise, Gab, is it?
No, we've been saying this all along. Yeah. They want to make some sort of net profit of 100 million. They want to cut 15% of wages. A good start would be the out of contract players, right? There's still questions. Ooh, Ashley Young. Do we want to keep Ashley Young? I mean, I'm sorry, Ash. You make a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, let him go. There's been linked to Watford. Great.
Yeah, go back home.
Go to Watford. Go back home. At some point, you can't keep everybody, right? Yeah. So they need to cut the wage bill. They're briefing everybody that Hakimi is the guy they want to sell. I don't know, man. Are we sure we want to let Hakimi go?
He's such a big player for them this season.
I wonder if there's somebody else, if there's other ways to do it. But that's the big hole that they're in.
Yeah.
Ruben Neves is the latest player to be linked with a move into the Arsenal midfield. Good choice, Jules?
Well, I'm not so sure. Why Ruben Neves?
Because Arsenal don't have any midfielders not named Mohamed or Thomas
but
or Granit.
Is there no other players who can bring you more? I mean, I don't think he had a good season this year at all.
Didn't.
I'm not convinced at all about him at Arsenal. I'm not sure that's the right fit either.
The price being quoted was interesting because I don't... I'm struggling to remember now how much Wolves paid for Ruben Neves, but it was a lot of money.
Million, yeah. Something
and
like that easily. From
Portugal. Basically a similar price. He was so good when he was so young.
Yeah.
I kind of feel he hasn't really progressed in the last year.
Definitely not. And I think there was also a big part of why he was good because João Moutinho next to him was so good and so in control of everything and so guiding in many ways. And I'm not so keen on that one. Lazio president Claudio Lotito has two clubs in Serie A, Gab. What's going on?
This is a
he can't have both two clubs. Can you imagine every time Salernitana and Lazio play each other, you just won't know what's going to happen?
Yeah, so he bought Salernitana, I think when they were in the third division or whatever, a couple years ago, and they said, oh, you can't have two clubs in the pyramid. And he got some legal injunction saying, no, I can, as long as they're not playing in the same league, blah, blah, blah. Now, obviously, Salernitana said, then they said, like, look, Claudio, deal with it, deal with it, deal with it. Obviously, he didn't. Now they've been promoted, and now he has to sell Salernitana. I think it has a deadline of like June 25th or something. But the absurdity is there's no reason for him to own two clubs in the same country. He knew this was coming. He's already complaining about the last Serie A assembly. They said you can't have two votes. You can only have one vote. You know, like you're still one owner. You have to sell Salernitana until you do that. Whoever buys it will get that vote. So he's complaining about that.
It's incredible.
It's just such a bad look.
But he would make money on Salernitana as well. Why is he so obsessed by keeping it?
I don't know if he will. Who knows? Who knows what kind of weird financial dealings he does and moving money around? Who knows what the debt is? Who knows who he's going to sell it to? Is he going to find some relative to sell it to? I hope imagine. They don't allow it. We shouldn't have to deal with this nonsense. Yeah, it should definitely. Be very simple. You're not allowed to own two professional clubs
like in every other country. It's not like just Italy. Exactly, it's everywhere.
Exactly. Ukraine unveiled their new shirt for the Euros, and Russia aren't happy about it, Jules.
They're not happy at all, Gab. It's the yellow shirt from Ukraine, but you've got a map, like made in the shirt, of Ukraine with Crimea within Ukraine. As you know, there's obviously a lot of diplomatic incident between the two countries over that region, and also some like nationalist slogans and stuff written inside the shirt as well. So Russia not happy at all about what Ukraine have done.
Russia, of course, annexing Crimea. But a lot of the international community it's
a little provocation from Ukraine, but
it's a provocation. It would be best if you don't use sport to go and annoy your larger neighbor.
Serie A will vote shortly on whether to spread each match day fixtures out over the entire weekend next season, like La Liga did, or like the Premier League did last season, or the season that just finished. So with no two games playing at the same time, for obviously TV reason. Do you like this, Gab, or?
No, I don't. I really don't. I mean, I'm not even sure that it necessarily. I mean, I get when the stadiums are closed doing it.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But it seems, first of all, I'm not convinced at all that it's going to necessarily increase TV audiences, because
there's no market for
nobody's
going
to sit there and watch 20 games or 10 Torino. Games one after the other. Yeah, no. I mean, if you're a Torino fan, you'll watch it regardless if it's playing at the same time as somebody else. So it'll move the needle a little bit, but it just kind of runs so. I'm not being traditionalist here. It just runs very counter. I mean, I'm not against, have four or five games at the same time, and then the other big ones, maybe spread them out. But this seems unnecessary. I personally hope it doesn't pass.
Yeah.
Right, that brings us to an end. But Jules, we got to come back on Thursday and do this again.
Yes.
Because on Thursday, we will officially be 24. By the time most of you listen to the Thursday show, we will be just over 24 hours away from the start of Euro 2020. Until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.